Welcome to the Health and Self-Care Podcast. My name is Dr. Andrew Tresidda, a Somerset doctor working in the NHS, and I'm joined by my friend and colleague,
Dr. Kate Staveley, also a GP from Somerset.
And we're really pleased today to welcome Dr. Claire Plumley. Claire, please introduce yourself.
Hi, thank you for having me. I work locally in Taunton as a clinical psychologist. I run an associate practice called Plum Psychology. So we are a group of trauma-trained psychologists who work both online and in Taunton, offering therapy to people who want to overcome and recover trauma, anxiety, and burnout. And I'm also an author on that topic, which is how I fell on your radar.
Which is great, because we're going to talk about, am I burnt out today? But before we do that, Claire, your ears may have been burning this morning, but you came highly recommended by an NHS colleague who I was talking to on my way into a meeting in Bridgewater. So your book is called Burnout, How to Manage Your Nervous System Before It Manages You.
I've never written a book before, and there were already a few pretty good books out there available on this topic. So does the world need another book on burnout? But there wasn't one written by a clinician that followed the pathway through to recovery that a clinician would follow. So assessment, all the background kind of factors that lead to it, including like systemic factors as well as your own internal psychological factors that might be playing more of a role than we sometimes realize. And then, you know, pathways out of it, therapeutic pathways out of it. So, I tried to recommend another book to my husband, and he kind of gave it back to me and said, no, this isn't right. So I said, right, I better write you a book then. So I sat down and wrote a book that could be accessible to both genders.
Oh, that's a great story. We'd better start by, could you help us define what burnout actually is? Is there a precise definition that helps us?
Yeah. So, there is a definition in the World Health Organization and the ICD-11. It doesn't appear in the DSM in this format, but it's not considered a psychiatric diagnosis per se, but as a syndrome where there are three presenting issues that co-occur. So the first one is, I think a lot of people tend to recognize that physical exhaustion, but it is more than that. It's not just physical, it's also emotional exhaustion, which I think when you hear that, it sounds a little bit baffling. Like, how can your emotions get exhausted? The way I describe it to my clients is that if you think about the full repertoire of emotions that we normally have access to, from feeling content to feeling happy and excited, often we don't have that. And it's our repertoire is much narrower, and we just oscillate between overwhelmed and anxious, or shut down and cynical and closed off and depressed and low. So that's the first part of the syndrome. The second part is a detachment. So you start to detach from the things that used to light you up and give you joy. Some people just describe that they're going through the motions. And maybe they, you know, not, or they might say things like, well, I love my kids, but I don't really want to be anywhere near them. things like that. If you're saying anything like that to yourself, then that's a sign of detachment. And then there's reduced accomplishment. So you start to drop a few balls. You know, you might be juggling quite a lot. You might start to cut corners. You know, when I was going through some functional burnout, I wasn't doing all the beautiful session plans that I was used to doing anymore. Or you might start to turn up to meetings late or without having prepared, and all these kind of, you're not really turning up in the way you would like to. So that's the official definition of burnout, but all of this has to take place in the context of unmanaged chronic occupational stress. In my book, though, I am arguing for a broader definition of occupational, because we tend to understand that as meaning paid occupation only. And actually, if you stop and think about all the different places in which you're turning up and doing work, a lot of people listening will be parents or have other dependents, because their carers are in that kind of middle squash generation where they're kind of also got elderly parents, or perhaps you care for someone with extra needs, or you're studying and you're trying to juggle the studying, which is often unpaid. There's lots of ways in which, you know, there might be stressors.
And how's that different from depression?
So depression, you've got to think about context, and there's a lot of non-specific things that show up in burnout that could tick a lot of other boxes like anxiety disorders and depression. So you're thinking about the context. There are typical pressures that you see that lead to burnout, such as overwhelm in terms of level of workload, in terms of lack of community and support with your workload, lack of control over your work. So there are a few different things like that, which I go into in my book in more detail. So it does help if you can look through those. Usually we can then contextualize and understand why we're responding that way, whereas depression often needs a little bit more digging around. It's a bit more diffuse. There might be some like lifelong kind of difficulties with mood, which might come from some other kind of difficult places. But it's usually a little bit more easy to pinpoint with burnout.
And are some people more prone to burnout than others?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. When I was trying to tease apart the research for this, it was tricky because there's many different groups to try and assess and measure. There is a bit in the book about who seems to be more prone according to the research. So leaders, people who are in leadership roles are quite lonely up at the top. They're less likely to have taken their foot off the gas or be used to doing that in order to have got to the level they're at. So if anyone's listening to this in a leadership role, think about yourself. People from different ethnic backgrounds that aren't considered the majority are more likely to have had to work hard to get over stigma and discrimination and might not have had good access to resources. So there's anywhere there's power imbalance will be impacting on people. For the other groups.
Are there any phases in life? We read a lot about menopausal women.
Oh, yeah.
Area. Are they more likely to get burnout?
I can't tell you off the top of my head, I'm afraid. I don't know. But I do know, so I don't know what the research says, but I do know anecdotally that is a group that asked that question a lot. Is it perimenopause? Is it menopause? Is it depression? Am I burnt out? And usually whenever I'm talking about this with that group of people, I'm saying actually it could be a little bit of all of that. It's quite hard to separate it out, but it's good to be mindful. And actually a lot of the nervous system regulation that you would be doing for one area is kind of applicable to all of this. So mm-hmm. It's about being kind of aware of what all the pressures are, teasing them apart, like I've just started to do with you here. Because often, you know, that squeezed middle group, you're also often at a point in your career where you've got a lot of responsibilities as well as maybe having kids, as well as your hormones being out of whack. So just doing the pacing, doing all the work you can do to understand all the stresses is going to be helpful in managing it. But I do think it's quite hard to tease it all apart for that age group. I would also say it's also worth going and seeing your GP and seeing if they've got a menopause clinic and getting, you know, any tests done. Certainly it's something I've done at this age, and it has been helpful just to start for myself some HRT, and just it's like one thing I could do for myself, so definitely would consider that.
If you think you're burnt out, what would you say is the first thing you ought to think about doing?
I mean, first of all, if you're thinking that, well done, because it means you're finally stopping and noticing. So I think in functional burnout, people tend to plow on and they're so busy in it they don't stop to think about themselves, so just hats off to you if you're doing that. I always think it's helpful to sit down with someone and try and talk it out. If you don't have someone you could do that with, to try and do it with a pen and paper, like what are all the stressors? Like if you've got access to my book, I've given you all the typical ones. Often when I see someone in therapy, when we do this, we just begin to see the wood for the trees a little bit, that actually, yes, there is this awful new boss at work who's breathing down my neck, or there's a change of systems that I haven't wrapped my head around, or there's some new micromanagement that wasn't happening before. Oh, and you know, I'm moving house. Oh, and so once we kind of get a sense of all the different stresses, we can then see where the low hanging fruit is to try and do some interventions. So, you know, it might be that there's some external support that we don't see as being accessible. When you talk it out with someone, you can begin to see where there might be some wiggle room for support. But I mean, ideally, I would love to say just take a break. You just need a break. But we all know that actually when we're in that part of our nervous system, the possibility of taking a break is often very hard. And practically it's hard as well if you've got a lot of responsibilities and you're working.
I'd love us to talk more about the nervous system, because that's, you go into it so well in your book. But just to ask, a model I've heard is that burnout is almost inevitable if you allow your mental, emotional, spiritual and physical fuel tanks to run on empty for too long, any one of them, or certainly if you're letting two or three, and many of us will have driven up the motorway and been very glad that we didn't run out of fuel. But it's no, there's no convenient place on the motorway to run on fuel. I don't know if that's a bit too simplistic for a...
No, I like it. And I don't know if you've seen the jobs, demand and resources model. So I've kind of got my hands in the air and I'm weighing them up and down like weighing scales. Because essentially you can have lots of demands weighing on you, but as long as you've got that balance of the resources, and that's what you're talking about there, you get resourced from your social connections, your hobbies, your spiritual beliefs. Yeah, time away from work, psychologically having a break from work is really important. And the research shows it's more important the more demanding your work is. Unfortunately, it's also harder the more important, like more demanding your work is, because quite often we have everything following us, don't we, in the form of emails and beeps and everything on our phones. But if you've got, you know, you're not trying to remove just all the demands, you're trying to get balance with also to filling up those buckets that you just described.
So many people, Claire, know a little bit about the autonomic nervous system, our body's inner management system, and they've heard of the sympathetic, which is the fight and flight, and they've heard a bit about dopamine, they've heard of the parasympathetic, which is about chill, rest, digest, chill, repair, tend and befriend. But the parasympathetic, there's been research that hasn't really been explained very well. It hasn't been taken on board at medical schools and elsewhere from Stephen Porges and others. And you have really laid this out so nicely in your book. What is polyvagal theory and how is it relevant to burnout?
So Stephen Porges, who you just referenced there, is the creator of polyvagal theory. And he's a neuroscientist. Anyway, he developed this theory off the back of some research with little babies, where they discovered that babies who appeared quite calm didn't always thrive. Some of them actually died. And so him and his colleagues kind of researched this a little bit more to see what was going on and realized that there were actually kind of three branches of the autonomic nervous system. So the autonomic nervous system, just to backtrack for anyone who's thinking, what's the nervous system? Because I have had that when I've launched into talking about it. And then some people realize maybe don't use that terminology all the time. It is the part of your body that's responsible for keeping you safe. So it's always on, always scanning for signs of trouble through our environment and through the people around us. And it's neurocepting, so picking up at a pre-conscious level whether the environment around us is safe or not. And it acts, again, without our conscious awareness very quickly if it picks up any signs of danger. And so the three branches of the nervous system that the two that you're saying are very well known about, and I think has typically been talked more about in stress literature, is the parasympathetic nervous system, which is the ventral vagal branch, is our green rest and digests. So I kind of talk about it in terms of a gear on your car. Like that's gears 2 to 3. You're poofing around. You can easily kind of town, you can easily kind of stop if you need to, or go into sixth if you kind of need to get into the motorway. And then when demands start coming in at us and we have to quickly respond, our nervous system has that ability to quickly fire up, so we're mobilized for action into our fight or flight. And that's our sympathetic or amber, going up to sixth gear, quick energy, everything feels a bit urgent and frenetic. Our thinking styles shift to be quite kind of rigid and kind of fast as well. And that works well for us. Assuming a stressor comes in, we can fix it and move on. We can come down back into our kind of gears 2 to 3 and feel calm again. The problem with everyday life is often those stressors are incessant. They're coming in and they're small. They're firing at us often in ways we don't realize. You know, a typical example of this is, you know, when people leave their mobile phone on their bed next to them. And without them even realizing, and the research backs this up, there's, you know, that feeling of, what if someone texts me? Will it buzz through the night? You're not actually switching down into your rest and digest mode as well as you would if the phone's not there. So there's constant stimulation everywhere, even when we don't realize. And so when that happens and there's no way out, then we can slip into the final branch of our nervous system, which is the dorsal. So it's another part of the parasympathetic nervous system. And it's the shutdown place we go to when our attempts for fight or flight have failed us, when they haven't resulted in the demands or stresses coming in at us. And so in the animal kingdom, when you see a predator chase the prey and the prey can't possibly outrun the predator, you'll see it do this. If you've ever watched any David Attenborough, you'll see the animal just collapse and, you know, stop breathing. And that might seem like an odd way of kind of getting through a moment of crisis, that you just stop and lie there because the risk seems high that you'll be eaten. But actually what happens is the predator feels like, well, the thrill of the chase is gone. Its sympathetic system isn't being activated anymore. It doesn't want to eat this anymore because it looks like a dead animal will wander off. So whilst we might not appear to actually collapse, our version of that is to become detached, which is what we described earlier on in burnout. So you're just going through the motions. You're not really connected to the emotions of the moment anymore. Some people describe feeling like they're up in their head. You also will not care so much anymore. This is all a survival strategy so that it's not so intense, because if you don't care so much, nothing can hurt you. So that's, you know, it's a form of dissociation, all of this. It's what we describe and been talking about a lot in trauma therapy for many years. And what I've done is applied this to the trauma of burnout, because that's how I see it playing out for my clients. And why I wanted to write this book and bring this extra information, because I thought people need to understand why they're just oscillating between amber and red, which is what we see in burnouts. They're often just stuck between those two gears and they're not coming back into that green rest and digest. And once you understand it's not your fault, it's just a sign of where your nervous system is at, that brings the compassion and the ability to start to go, okay, what do I need to learn in order to become good at driving my own nervous system? This beautiful bit of kit I've been given, which has the ability to support us through high stress, but only when we know how to navigate it.
And therefore, very important that we're all much kinder to ourselves, isn't it? I think as a society, we like people that are in the red zone, and we give them great praise, don't we? And yet, when people take their foot off the gas pedal, we're not very kind to them, and we're not kind to ourselves when we find ourselves in that situation.
I think that's a good point. Actually, I think red shutdown. So the kind of dorsal shutdown can look like functional freeze and fawning, where people are just kind of like, yes, sir, no, sir, three bags full, sir, but getting on with it. Do you know what I mean? Like they're just passively going through the motions, which can be confusing on the outside if you don't really see what's going on, or you didn't know that person before they got like that. Or if it just suits the system to have someone like sleepwalking through their work, but getting it done.
And I think an area I'm particularly interested in is neurodivergence. And I think neurodivergent people demonstrate that very well, don't we? We often see fawning and masking. And there is a theory now that the autonomic nervous system is much more important in that particular group of people. So are they more prone to burnout?
Yeah, I mean, certainly that's... people are realizing that now, and I think that's quite helpful. I think just having that terminology, you know, ADHD burnout, autistic burnout, has been a real relief. And because like you say, people are much more likely to have had to mask in order to feel like they fit in. There's often a lot of trauma around, you know, not being understood, not having a place to fit in, having to try and work hard to be a square peg in a round hole. And that's exhausting, and means that every little thing you do, you have to turn up the energy levels to max. But also, you know, that group often are less connected to their interoception, their ability to listen to their body and respond appropriately. So you will often hear people saying like, well, I didn't notice I was hungry, or, you know, so actually having to, often in burnout work, whether you're neurodivergent or not, support people to come back to listening to their body. Often, if you say that, people don't even know what that means. Mm-hmm. So I talk about that in my book quite a bit, because if you can rebuild that ability to understand what your body's saying, it's hard to push through the stress incessantly.
Claire, you've got lots of great, not just tips, but great programs in your book for helping people get better. But can I just ask you to tease out one other thing, which you put so nicely in the book, which is why we act the way we do from a personality level because of our early childhood experiences. I'm talking about attachment theory. What is attachment theory, and what sort of attachments are there? And I suppose the three questions that sit alongside that we all have at every point in our lives is, do I feel safe? Do I feel loved and or respected? And do I belong?
So attachment theory is the idea that humans have a very strong need for survival. As part of their survival depends on their strong attachments to other humans. And so from the moment we're born, we're built to seek out those attachments, that relationship with our primary caregivers. And you can tell that because, you know, a baby is born turning its face towards the sound of its mother's voice. It's looking for signs of facial patterns. So these are all the inbuilt cues that's what babies are built to do. And so we, you know, attachments aren't just important for baby survival. They're important also into adulthood because, you know, if you know any time in your life when you've had an attachment end or rupture, it's so painful. You know, if someone dies, if someone leaves you, that pain is telling you this is important to me. So the problem, if you don't have what's called a secure attachment early on, which means that the parent or primary caregiver was there, attuned to your needs and regularly able to meet them, you can get these attachment styles that lead into adulthood, which impact on the way you relate to others because of a fear that your needs won't be met in a way. So that impacts on your relationship to others, but also your relationship to yourself and to work, because you're often trying to fix that attachment wound through any means possible. And work is obviously an easy way to do that. And there are four attachment styles: secure, which I've already alluded to, and avoidant, which is when parenting was typically quite dismissive of your needs and emotions. And how this can play out as being problematic in work is that you might become hyper-independent because you don't want to be too much. You don't want to have any needs. So you will ignore signs of stress or any tricky emotions. See, again, there's that not listening to your body thing. It'll push you to keep going. You keep throwing yourself into work. And also it can mean that intimacy is difficult. And so if there's any trickiness in your relationships, sometimes I found that people will avoid that by throwing themselves into work even more. So there's this insecure striving to avoid feeling inferior, which is that perfectionism that you've referred to. And a second attachment style is an anxious attachment, which is when our parents might have struggled to soothe themselves or might have been overly protective or perhaps needy, which means in adulthood that you'll be quite sensitive to the needs of others. You'll be picking up cues that people, you know, are unhappy very easily. And so you'll be hyper responsive to that. So that's the people pleasing aspect. So we'll kind of make sure to avoid other people upsetting. Getting upset, we're doing all the things. So you can see how that leads to burnout as well. And if your self-worth feels dependent on keeping others happy or how they perceive you, that's exhausting because you're only ever as happy as the person closest to you is, or the people around you, which is impossible. We know that's impossible logically, but in our hearts, we can find that hard to take on board. So those are two important ones. And there's one called disorganized attachment, which is a bit of a blend of all of those, but it comes from parenting that was very disorganized and hard for you to kind of know what strategy would work. I think knowing about attachment styles does really help. So there is a section in the book, like you say, that helps people start to understand that. And, you know, the key to supporting your relationship with work and with your attachment style is through your relationship with yourself. And you can focus on that through therapeutic techniques, which is what we do in therapy.
So I think the important message there is nobody is above getting burnout, is there? Nobody is too strong, too capable to get burnout.
Happen to anyone.
It can happen to anyone. That's what I was trying to say. Complicated.
Yes, and I think I don't want to undermine, and we haven't really talked about external factors. Obviously, systemic factors, external factors, we haven't even gone into that in very much detail. They play a massive role, but they all trigger our stress response. And how we respond when things get stressful is we tend those our Achilles heel will kind of get worse. Is that even a phrase that makes sense? But, you know, so
there's one there.
Yeah, the tendencies we already had will worsen and cause us more problems.
And it's not a sign of weakness to acknowledge that we're all human beings and we all have our own physiological needs. I think that's a lot important, because a lot of people feel they somehow have to be better than it and keep going just to prove that they can, and that other people who succumb are weaker somehow and that we're above that. But that's not the case, is it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Claire, I love how your book helps us with the explanations you've just given us, and so much more, and the answers. And I don't think we've got the time to go into the answers, but your book is superb for anybody who wants to learn about burnout or who is suffering it. Do you think there's an educational need through society, through the workplace? And I'm particularly interested personally in the health of the NHS workforce. Do you think there's an educational gap?
I think in terms of the role that compassion should be playing at every level, yes, I think there's more need there. And I know the local NHS are starting to roll that out to leaders, which is really good. I think it needs to go all the way to the top, to our government. I think if they had more understanding about how compassion works, because then it filters into our policies and the way that we, you know, recruit and how much resource we give, how much support we give, and less focus on outcomes and targets that are quite tricky to measure sometimes. Certainly in mental health where I worked, some of the targets fell. They're putting unnecessary pressure on us to try and prove our worth. And you can't really measure well-being and mental health in some of the ways that, you know, they were trying to capture. And so that led to micromanaging, like things like that, that just don't make sense. You know, if people could understand that kind of biopsychosocial model more clearly. Yeah, I think there's lots of potential for input, I think.
It would be helpful. Certainly, I was talking to a team in our mental health services in Somerset this morning, and showed your book, and somebody said, "Oh, can I have that one?" And I thought, "Okay, you please do, because you obviously resonate with it, and if it helps you, that's great." Claire, what last tips would you like to give us? And then Kate, if you'd like to say anything extra, and I'll just have the last word.
My really quick tip for anyone listening who just wants something super practical to do from this conversation is think about the transition points in your day. So for example, for us, it'll be after this podcast, as you move to the next activity, to try, there's a gap there, to try and use that as a check-in point. Like what does your body say it needs? So quite often when I've been looking at the screen, like I am right now, I get all huddled and I get tension up in my neck and my shoulders. So just to move and respond to what your body needs before you crash into the next thing. There's more practical tips, but that's just like a super quick one that hopefully anyone listening to this could try.
That's great. Kate, I'll bring you in a second. But actually, our bodies are full of muscles. They're designed to move. And the sympathetic nervous response is actually to get us moving. And of course, we live in a world where we often don't move. We're sitting in a car, or we're sitting in an office or a desk. So the tension is there, but we respond by inactivity, which can't be good for us when muscles are designed to move. Kate?
I'd just like to thank you very much, Claire. I think that's been a really interesting whistle-stop tour. And I'm certainly going to read your book now, because I haven't seen it, but it sounds absolutely fascinating. And I think it always brings me back to the same thought, which is we're all human beings. We're all on the same journey. And we all need to be kinder to ourselves and to each other and just recognise our humanness, as it were. So thank you very much, Claire.
Thank you. Yeah, we're not machines, we're humans. And if anyone's listening thinking, I don't have time to read a book, I'm too burnt out, it's also available as an audio book.
Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. And thank you, everybody, for listening today.
Thank you.
Well.